You're listening to The Radiator, 105.9 FM, WOMM, LP, Burlington, Vermont. I'm Shayla Shapiro, and this is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. Write the Book features interviews with authors, poets, illustrators, agents, and editors. Today on Write the Book, you're going to hear an interview with the author Jean Zimmerman. Throughout her writing career, Jean Zimmerman has published critically acclaimed nonfiction that focuses on the changing role of women in America. Her debut novel is The Orphan Master, published in June by Viking. Her previous work, Love Fiercely, a Gilded Age romance, is a history that focuses on the lives of the great chronicler of New York City, I.N. Phelps Stokes, and his iconic wife, Edith. Preservationists, philanthropists, and denizens of Gilded Age Manhattan. Before that, her book, The Women of the House, How a Colonial She-Merchant Built a Mansion, a Fortune, and a Dynasty, was an Original Voices selection, Borders, 2006, and Washington Irving Book Selection, Westchester Library Association, 2007. An honors graduate of Barnard College, Jean Zimmerman earned an MFA in writing from the Columbia University School of the Arts. She lives with her family in Westchester County, New York. The Orphan Master tells the story of Blondine, a beautiful, determined female trader in 1663 New Amsterdam, the Dutch colony at the foot of Manhattan Island. Blondine sees orphans go missing and decides to catch the killer before it's too late. The Orphan Master is a love story wrapped around a murder mystery, and it draws on Zimmerman's copious research into the history of early Manhattan. I interviewed Jean Zimmerman by phone 1 week ago, and I began by mentioning the dedication in the preliminary pages of The Orphan Master, which reads simply, "For us." The first thing I was going to say about the book actually wasn't a question, but just a comment. I loved the dedication that you put in the front of the book, which I know isn't necessarily for readers, but it is fun as a reader to your dedication was for the both of us.
Yeah, and you know, it's really for my husband and I. My husband is also a writer. He's a great writer, uh-huh. And we're really partners in everything. We read each other's work. We edit each other's work. He's really my best first editor. So,
right.
So that's why I wanted to dedicate it to him.
Yeah, I loved that because as a reader, it sounds a little bit like it's both for the author and the reader. But I knew it was probably more about something more personal. And then in your afterword, I read that he had asked you to write him a novel, and I loved that.
So. Right. Actually, he asked me to write him a murder, which is specific. And I had been sort of hemming and hawing about writing a novel, feeling like as a nonfiction writer that it would be difficult for me to do.
Yeah.
And he said to me, you know, write me a murder. And
yeah.
That was something that I felt that I actually could do.
Yeah. Now, so how long ago did you start this project?
Well, it depends on what you mean by start this project. I started thinking about it way back when I was working on my book, The Women of the House, which is about a Dutch family that emigrated to New Amsterdam in the 1660s. And when I worked on that book, there was a woman named Margaret Hardenbrook who was a great fur trader. So she was a real person, and she was so successful that she ended up being the richest woman in New York by the time of her death. And she was a fascinating person. I loved writing about her, and I loved writing about the time. But I felt that, you know, to write about a woman of that time, it's very difficult to get all the documents, the materials that you would like, the letters, the memoirs, that kind of thing. So it started me thinking, you know, I'd really like to write about a woman of that time and to sort of write around the edges of history and to do something that is based on a real person but that uses my imagination. So
yeah.
That's where it started all the way back then, which was years ago now. And then I was thinking about it, you know, all along this time, and the actual writing didn't take as long as you would think because I think I was sort of prepped to do it.
Yeah, okay. And so it sounds, again, from having read your afterword, I know that, in fact, there were women in that time period who were traders and artists and maybe took on other professional roles in 17th century New Amsterdam, which is Manhattan Island. So what about that time period and culture created this opportunity for women?
Well, in Holland, women were freer than women any place in the world at that time, anywhere. And there were, I guess, a bunch of cultural phenomena that colluded to make this happen, but the end result was that women were what was called she merchants in large numbers. You know, women had an education, a primary education, alongside boys, and they could inherit money equally from their parents when they died. And so I think that these factors combined to allow women to be in business, to be in commerce, and they were very, very good at it. So when women came over from Holland, they came out of this tradition. And so Blondine Vancouvering, my main character in The Orphan Master, she is a she merchant. But, you know, there were many people. I read someplace that there were out of about 1,500 to 2,000 settlers in New Netherland at that time. Mm-hmm. There were about 200 female traders. So that's an enormous number, you know, you can imagine.
Yeah, right. Do you think that it also had anything to do with the new world and everything still being established and it just being sort of crazy and chaotic and such a bustling new culture? Do you think that had anything to do with it or not?
Well, I'm sure that offered opportunities for anybody who wanted to get into the business. The fur trade was just exploding at that time, and that is the basis on which the new world in that area, in the Hudson Valley that I'm writing about, mm-hmm. of New York, that's where it was centered. And that's why people were coming over to the new world and making new lives for themselves and creating fortunes in the fur trade. So anybody that could do that was welcome, and women included. So there were a lot of women who were merchants in the fur trade at that time. And it was kind of a rough-and-tumble atmosphere and very exciting and electric, and women were a part of that.
Okay. All right, great. You mentioned Blondine a minute ago, your main character. I consider her your main character. There are actually a number of main characters in this book, but she was the one I kept sort of like focused on.
Right.
So I wonder if you can talk, and actually Edward as well. Edward Drummond. Drummond. So can you talk about the process you went through in choosing or maybe finding your protagonists, particularly maybe Blondine and Edward?
Well, Blondine, as I said, I based on a real person and who was also in her early 20s and was a trader at that time in New Amsterdam, and she was actually spunky and rather fierce and determined. Blondine, I also wanted to give a real heart to, and to she's an orphan as well, and a number of the victims, in fact, all of the victims in the book are orphans also.
Right.
So she has a kind of an acute sensitivity to the orphans and to their problems and to their issues. So that's how she evolved. Drummond was, I wanted to create a man who was sort of a man of the new learning at that time. He's an Englishman. He's a spy. He works for Charles II, and he really is, in that day, a modern man. He has sat at the feet of Spinoza, so he's sort of got a modern way of thinking about religion, as well as working with glass, which Spinoza did also, interestingly. And Drummond works with glass also. But I wanted him to be sort of, I call him the sensitive stud. He's kind of a hero, dry but also sensitive in a manly way. You know, it sounds like such a cliche, but he's more than a romance novel hero, even though that's the way I'm portraying it.
Yeah, absolutely. And you've just mentioned romance novel, and I wanted to ask you about genre a little bit. This book to me seems mostly historical fiction, but you know, there's mystery and romance and suspense. So I wondered what your attitude is toward genre classifications, and then also sort of setting aside whatever stereotypes there are of genre, what would you say a good literary romance requires?
So. Good literary romance. Well, in terms of The Orphan Master, when I was working on it, I didn't put it in any category. I wasn't writing it as a genre mystery or a genre historical. Mm-hmm. It was a story, and it was a story I wanted to tell, and I wanted it to be kind of a wild story in a certain way, to bring in, you know, for me, every day new characters would sort of spring up out of the ground, which was really exciting. And, you know, when I last counted, I had, there are like 72 characters in The Orphan Master.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of, opportunity for different kind of relationships and different different characters. But anyway, and then of course there's the character of Manhattan itself, you know, which is probably overarching the whole thing.
Yeah, absolutely.
So genre doesn't really interest me that much because I think that it's just a work as a whole. And I don't know. I mean, it is. It turns out to be a mystery. You know, it turns out to be a murder mystery, but that's not how I intended it. And then in terms of, what did you say, literary romance?
Yeah, well, I think of your writing as very literary and rich and full of wonderful language and detail. On the other hand, there's a romance happening in it. So, you know, I just wondered if that crosses over into the romance genre at all, or if it's just sort of like what you're saying, not that important to classify it.
Right. Well, you know, as we all are, I'm a big fan of Jane Austen. And so as I did have a slight model in my mind as I was working on the relationship between Blondine and Drummond. You know, they take a step forward towards each other, and then they take two steps back, and they distrust each other, and then they are fascinated by each other. And it goes on like that for some of the book. And I loved that, and I was, you know, I loved creating them and kind of moving them. You know, I always think of it as sort of playing with dolls. You know, you create these two characters and you sort of move them towards each other and then away from each other. And I was, you know, like I feel when I'm reading an Austen novel. And you're rooting for the characters to come together by the end of the book, and you're like, they have to come together, they have to come together. I even felt that about Blondine and Drummond, you know, and I was writing it myself. They have to come together. So that was really, really fun. I don't know if it's a traditional literary romance, but that was a big part of it in my mind, certainly.
Yeah. Well, one comment I would make about, I think, what made their relationship so much fun as a reader is that her initial reaction to him is quite negative. She thinks that he's a fop, he's acting a role, he's aware of being watched, he's posing, you know. So all of this, I think, fits really well with having secrets, which everybody in the book has secrets, which we can talk about in a minute. But it also sort of sets up the romance because she notices him and has strong feelings for him even before she recognizes that those feelings might not be all negative, you know?
Right. Well, you know, Blondine is, if she's anything, she is so genuine. You know, she's honest. She thinks that she's very sincere. And the idea that anybody is a poser or just offends her so much. That's, I think, her reaction to Drummond. And that he's also, you know, she's an American, and she was born on Manhattan, which not that many people were at that time. So at one point she talks about how she believes that people in America are actually superior to people in the old world, you know, for various reasons. And I think that part of the reason that she distrusts him at the beginning is because he's from England.
Right. And even more so than she realizes, in a way.
Right. She doesn't know the half of it.
Well, okay, so that brings me to the importance of secrecy and intrigue in the book. And I loved how you kind of, you give us little hints as we go along about what is and what isn't, and what appears to be something other than it is. And so, like, for example, at one point early in the book, Drummond must appear a simple grain merchant newly arrived in search of his lodgings. So clearly that's not really what he is, but at this stage of the novel we aren't quite sure exactly who or what he is, so that's kind of fun. There was one other example I was going to mention, which is just sort of at one point knowing that Drummond has this telescope or spyglass on top of his roof. Blondine pretends to be surprised that he has it on his roof, and she says, "Were you spying on me?" But in fact, she was sort of also spying on him. So it goes – anyway, it's really fun, all the secrecy and intrigue, and I wonder if you can talk about the importance of that in the book.
Yeah, well, I mean, that creates kind of leads and false leads, and that creates some of the mystery because they, everybody believes that something is true. It turns out to be false, and that's very true of Blondine and Drummond, but it's certainly true of some of the other characters as well. I mean, like somebody like the Orphan Master. What is true about the Orphan Master? I mean, I even feel like I don't know what's true about the Orphan Master. He's such a complicated and troubled man, and he's a guy who does good, you know, in terms of the orphans that he takes care of. But you know that that he also is embroiled in something that is much deeper and darker. So I think that his duality is kind of, it's something that is reflected in the rest of the book as well. And some of the other characters also are like somebody like the young orphan who goes by the name of William for most of the book.
Right.
We don't quite know, what he is about. I mean, he can't speak. He can speak. He's William. He's not William.
Right.
It's again, it's out of the same thing. There, almost everybody has a backstory that we don't really know totally what's going on.
Yeah, and that was a wonderful plot twist, and it's set up when the orphan master, is it Eight? Is that how you say his name?
Eat.
So he's talking to Drummond, and he says, this boy, I don't think it's the same boy that I took there, recently. And I went back, and it's a different boy. And it was like, wow, that was such a great, exciting thing to read and think, wow, who is this kid? And why is it a different kid? Anyway.
Yeah. It's interesting. I actually had much more about him in the book and decided not to use it. And there's a sort of the lost chapter about him on my website if anybody ever wants to read it on GeneZimmerman.com. I mean, he's a wonderful little guy, and I just it wasn't balanced to put so much about him in.
Right, and that's an interesting subject in itself. With a book that's got quite so much going on, it must have been a real challenge to revise and get it as tight as you might need it to be for people to be able to follow everything that's going on.
Yeah, I solved that by making it a pretty rambling book, keeping it much of it. But yeah, there were times that I had to trim it in terms of like a plot for plot reasons, and that was always very difficult. Something like Gypsy Davy, a character who I loved a lot, well, I don't want to give it away, but anyway, he can't stay in the book forever.
Right.
And that was very, very sad.
Yeah, yeah, that's got to be hard to make those decisions.
Yeah.
So I wonder if you can talk a little bit about the religious atmosphere in New Amsterdam at this time period and punishments for worshiping outside. Is it the Dutch Reformed Church?
Mm-hmm, yeah. Well, first let me say that there were all different kinds of people in New Amsterdam at that time. I mean, when you walk down the street, you could hear 18 different languages being spoken. So you know that there were a lot of cultures and there were a lot of ways to worship at the time.
Mm-hmm.
Basically, the Dutch welcomed anybody, as I said, anybody who could engage in successful commerce that would help make the settlement successful. But at the same time, there were, like Peter Stuyvesant, who was the director general at the time, he was very disapproving of certain religions, like, say, Judaism, as an example.
Mm-hmm.
And so he came to a compromise with the directors of the settlement back home, because they said, no, we want to have everybody who can engage in business. And he said, but I don't like these people. And so the compromise was actually that that Jews could worship, but they couldn't build a temple. They had to worship in somebody's home. So there was that kind of thing. I mean, it was a time when there people were kind of jostling for what was the proper way to worship. And then some of the characters in The Orphan Master, they represent that in the fact that some of them are trying to figure out exactly who God is.
Mm-hmm.
And say Drummond, who, as I said, he's a big fan of Spinoza. Well, Spinoza is redefining the face, or I should say the non-face. He's defining an abstract God, and Drummond is coming to believe in that. And Blondine, for her part, has sort of turned her back on God because she feels so distressed at the death of her parents and her sister in a shipwreck.
Mm-hmm.
And so she's just searching also. And then another character, Martin Hendrickson, is also questing in his own way, but he is basically a nihilist, and so he's thrown God totally out the window.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of people are trying to, you know, explore religion in their own different way. And I think that's very representative of the time. It was a very searching time.
Yeah. And I as we're speaking here, it's occurring to me again, just how much I loved how the novels sort of, I think you said rambling a minute ago, but it's like the novel's sense just reflects this time period so much. So many different peoples and cultures coming together and creating something new and trying to find their way. And the way you wrote this book was really wonderful in reflecting all of that.
Mm-hmm. Well, there were. I mean, even when you look at Native Americans and all the different tribes at that time and the level of interaction with Europeans in Manhattan, say, I think people aren't aware of that there was that interaction, and that especially in terms of trading, you know, which happens in the book when Blondine is trying to she's trying to obtain the furs that she needs to trade, and goes up to Albany, which I call Beaverlick at that time.
Mm-hmm.
They know each other, they have relationships with each other. And I don't think that is accurately reflected most of the time.
Mm-hmm. And then another aspect of all of these different peoples coming together is that they weren't all always speaking the same language. And there was an interesting moment in the book, or a couple interesting things in the book. One is something that you referred to a minute ago, which is that Drummond is sort of researching how he feels about God. And at one point you mentioned that he's reading a book called Korte Verhandeling von God. And then you write, which full title in English would be A Short Treatise on God, Man, and His Well-Being. And, there aren't a lot of foreign words in the book, but there are some, and they reflect the times. And I was just wondering if you could talk a little bit about your approach to translation, how much can be left unexplained for the reader, and how much do you have to translate, so that everybody knows exactly every word?
Yeah, that's a really, really good question that nobody has ever asked me before.
Oh, okay.
So let me think. You know, it is something, it's sort of a delicate subject, and as you go along, you want people, I wanted to use foreign words, especially words in Dutch, that I wanted people to understand the sense of what I was saying, of what I was writing. But I wanted to leave the authenticity of the words in some cases.
Mm-hmm.
So oftentimes I would use a word and then translate it, and then use it over and over again in the original language. And
okay.
I just felt that it should be sort of like a spice that you add. It had to be there, but it couldn't be there in overwhelming proportions, I would say.
Okay, great. Just to mention another moment that I noticed was, and the way that you play with the different languages also extends and kind of ramps up the mystery in certain places. Like at one point, these two brothers, the Hendrickson brothers, they speak Dutch together in front of Drummond, assuming that he cannot understand them, but in fact he can. And it's so much fun for us because we are enjoying how he's sort of telling us what they're saying. So.
Right. Well, that's Drummond. He knows a lot about a lot of things. So
yeah.
Whatever the situation is, he's going to have some savvy about it. You know that. But
and the
brothers are equally sort of, I'm showing their arrogance at the time, that they think that there's no way that Drummond would ever understand. But yeah, that is a funny scene.
Yeah, it's a great scene. And then an extension of what you're saying there, how he's, he knows everything and he's part of everything. So one thing I was really interested to read about, and it has to do with Drummond's background, is the Society of the Sealed Knot, which is a society of loyal monarchists. So how big was this group on this side of the Atlantic?
Well, let me think. That, first of all, it was a real group. I mean, it's historically accurate.
Yeah, it sounded like it.
Yeah, how big it was on this, that's, I think, something that, you'd have to use your imagination
okay.
to decide. But there were definitely Englishmen. There were lots and lots of Englishmen on Manhattan, which may be surprising, and that's something that's portrayed in The Orphan Master. But Englishmen who were loyal to the crown certainly existed, and you know, I've read before about people that came down from Connecticut or one of the English colonies and strolled around and took notes on the fort, you know, and sent them back to the king. So that's kind of a real thing also. That's something that Drummond and his friend Rieger, they do in the book. So it's not hypothetical, it's real.
Yeah, and I loved the way that they identify themselves to each other with this knot, this certain, like you can tie a certain knot, so that means that you're a part of this society. I thought that was really great.
Yeah, it's a little, you know, it's slightly ridiculous, I think, but at the same time, it would be true.
Yeah, it's fun. So to what extent, Jean, were you aware of creating red herrings and inventing characters who might fit the reader's expectations of murderers?
Well, that was deliberate. I mean, I that's what I wanted to do. I wanted the mystery to spread out in different areas. But you know, something I learned, you know, that you really have to make choices about when you're going to reveal your killer or killers.
Yeah.
And I kind of moved that chess piece around as I was working on it. And it wasn't until really the end of the book that I decided what that point was going to be. Of course, it's going to be different for all readers. You know, you may think or you may guess who it is on page 40 and somebody else may on page 350, you know.
Right.
But
right.
Where I wanted there to be hints, but also for people to think it could go in a different direction. You know, I wanted that to be going pretty much, you know, till about two-thirds of the way through.
It's funny because I was not one of those page 40 people. There were so many potential murderers in this book. It took me a long time. So I was, I was sort of...
I think I wanted to show that everybody has the capacity for evil. So it could have been anybody.
I really loved this one character that you created named Antony. He's such an interesting character, and he provides protection to Blondine and is concerned for her welfare, but he also sort of offers us this subjective point of view to lean on as readers. And for example, he likes Drummond at the beginning when Blondine does not yet, and so we can kind of, you know, look at Antony as a sort of gauge of I don't know. He was like a helpful guide for all of us, I thought. So.
Yeah, he's good. He's kind of the essence of good in a way.
Yeah.
And when you say he likes Drummond, he actually loves Drummond.
Yeah, right.
So that makes you. It does make you think that she can come to love Drummond also. But Antony, when you say I created him, it's funny. You know, he's one of those things in the book that that is actually based on reality.
Okay.
And if you look in the chronicles of New Amsterdam at that time, there was an Antony Angola, and he was an African giant who was accused of a murder and sentenced to hang for it. They put two ropes around his neck, thinking that that's what they needed to hold him, and the ropes broke and he tumbled to the ground, and he was freed after that. And so that really, really happened. The only thing that I did is sort of attach him to Blondine.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's so interesting to me that these amazing things happened back then, and all of this material is there in the historical record if you bother to go and look.
Yeah, I know. I was thinking as you were writing your nonfiction, you must have been just like taking tons of notes once you had decided that you also wanted to write fiction, because it just must be fascinating to do the research that creates this book.
I don't think you can imagine how many notes and notebooks I have. I mean, I think I have dozens. You know, and it's really hard for me to stop doing research because I love immersing myself in it, and I love the textures of the time so much. And I sort of had too much to leave it there and let it be. In a way, I had to write this novel.
So do you think that you're going to head back to nonfiction all the time, or do you feel like you're now going to write both, or do you prefer fiction? Or?
Well, I've already written another novel.
Oh, okay.
So for the time being, I'm working in the fiction mode. And in my new novel, it's also a historical murder mystery, but it takes place in 1875 in Gilded Age New York. And in this case also, I appropriated research material that I had used. I've also come out fairly recently with a nonfiction book called Love Fiercely,
okay.
A Gilded Age romance, and it's about a couple that lives in the Gilded Age, kind of remarkable people. But I had a lot of research materials that were sort of left over from that, and I applied them to my new novel.
All right.
So,
and your new novel is what? What can you tell us anything about it? Or
I'd love to. that's, you know, I sort of feel like that's my new baby, and I want to show it to everybody. But it won't be, but it won't be out for some time, so I have to, you know. Anyway,
yeah.
I have to tell people verbally. But anyway, it's about a teenage girl. It takes place. It begins in Nevada, in Silver Country, and this girl who is being exhibited as a sideshow sort of freak in Virginia City, Nevada, at the height of the silver boom in 1875, and she is she's being shown as somebody who was raised by wolves, or you know, a wild child or a feral child. And a couple who is very, very affluent comes out west from New York to inspect their silver mines.
Mm-hmm.
And they find her, and they adopt her, and they bring her back to New York to raise her up as a debutante. And, of course, murder and mayhem follow.
Of course.
Of course, yes. Of course.
You do have your husband.
She's a great character. It's called Savage Girl, and she's an amazing character.
Wonderful. So when does that come out?
I don't know whether it'll be a year. I just have turned it in fairly recently. So
okay.
a year and a half, something like that.
All right, great.
In the meantime, I have to be content with the Orphan Master coming, you know, with showing the Orphan Master around, which I'm really happy to do. And also, you know, the Orphan Master has been optioned for film.
Oh, wonderful.
So that's really exciting.
That is.
I don't have any timetable for that at all.
Yeah, I have heard from other authors that it's kind of hard sometimes when you finish a book and it's, you know, several years in the production of a book sometimes. And so all of a sudden you find yourself talking about something that you sort of felt like you were finished with a while ago.
Yeah, and that is true to some extent. It takes on a little bit of a different character, and you see it with a little, how can I say it, a little wistfulness, because
mm-hmm.
I see it, it's a little bit more objective and a little bit more wistful at the same time, to think that this was this thing. The real love you have is in working on the book, you know, the day-to-day working on the book, and that feeling of attachment you have, at least for me, that attachment you have to the manuscript. And then once it goes out to the world, it feels, it's sort of, in a way, somebody else's property.
Yeah. Talking about history, reading history, how do you know that a source is a good, reliable historical source when you, you know, let's say you wanted to write about World War II, and there's thousands of books that have been written about World War II. Where do you figure out where to start, and what source might be a good starting point?
Well, you know, my writing in recent years has been sort of a prolonged love letter to New York.
Mm-hmm.
So I would write, you know, I'm interested specifically in researching New York. And there's one Bible for that, and that's a book, it's actually a series of six volumes called The Iconography of Manhattan Island, and the author was I.N. Phelps Stokes. That's who my book, Love Fiercely, profiles, by the way. And this is a book, this is a series of books that encompasses every dimension, from maps to views to chronicles to, you know, every single thing about Manhattan up until about 1920 when it was published. And it's totally credible, you know. So I would say just, I don't know in terms of other fields or other places, but in terms of New York, if you're writing about New York, go there.
Okay.
That is the place to go, to a great research library. That's where you'll find it.
Well, I do have a couple more questions about the Orphan Master. One scene that I totally loved was the sewing circle scene. There's a group of women in the community that have come together to sew a trousseau for a new bride, and their conversation is fabulous. And it just starts out as sort of talk about community, and then it turns to gossip, and then it rises into something unkind, and eventually it turns really quite dangerous. So I was just wondering if you remember writing that specific scene, and how difficult was it to capture this dialogue so perfectly?
Well, of course, I didn't know whether or not I was capturing it perfectly when I was writing it, but it was a great pleasure to write, and it's one of my favorite scenes also. I just love those sort of silly women and the danger that they can do, even though they are so silly.
Yeah.
And I also love, I love the culture of women of the Netherlands at that time, and so what they're doing, sitting around and sewing linen items for this trousseau, and with tiny little stitches, and that they're sitting around and doing it, and in somebody's wonderfully clean grootkamer, or great room is just something that I relate to so much, and I was so, I felt so lucky to have an opportunity to put that in there.
Yeah.
But the dialogue, that wasn't that hard. You know, it just seemed natural to me, actually, and to write with this silly, I don't know, these silly things that came out of people's mouths.
Yeah, I guess one thing leading to another does mean that it might be a little bit of an organic process to write a scene like that. But I would think that starting out with the scene, you already know that where you want to get to. So I don't know. It just didn't feel at all forced. It didn't feel like you were rushing the danger. It just kind of came up so naturally. So I was very impressed.
At that, I didn't know where it was going to end up.
Oh, you
at
didn't?
All.
Oh, okay.
No, I was just writing it and wanting to write the scene and wanting it. Yeah, I wanted it to get kind of iffy, but I didn't know it was going to get as bad as it got.
Right. Okay. All right. Great. I wonder, you know, this actually may end up turning into the same sort of conversation as our talk a little while ago about genre, but I wondered if you could talk a little bit about narrative point of view, the narrative point of view of this book. Do you see it as more omniscient or a sort of shifting close third person?
Yeah.
I'm just wondering.
Yeah, it's certainly shifting. You know, I wanted you to be able to understand different characters' perspectives, and that was part of it, you know, so that if you know, one of the most mystical characters in the book, Katani, you know, I want you to be able to see Katani, you know, his point of view, and be inside his head, and not just for us to look at him and say, oh, here's this guy lying on his willow mat and, you know, describe what he looks like, but to know, you know, what he's seeing out of his eyes. And I guess I wanted that to be true also for Blondine and for anybody else, that I think pretty much everybody, actually. And that was more my interest than the omniscient narrator is not that interesting to me.
Mm-hmm.
The more the subjective omniscient is much more interesting.
Yeah. Let's see. I wanted to talk a little bit. This is hard for radio listeners sometimes, but I did want to talk about the cover because I love the cover. And I wonder if you had any input or if you just sort of had right of first refusal on the cover or anything. So, but if you wanted to talk about that.
Yeah, well, that's a good question. Well, you know, most authors don't have right of first refusal. They simply have the right to consult.
Yeah.
You know, and that's in your contract. Well, in this case, my publisher was so wonderful. I first saw a cover that didn't work, I thought, at all, and my literary agent didn't think so either. And we went back to them and said, you know, it looked a little bit like a women's romance novel,
mm-hmm.
and we didn't think that worked. And they said, okay, fine, we'll put together something else. And they came back with this, which I think is perfect,
yeah.
You know, sublime. I love it. And something interesting about it is if you go to the back flap and you look at the bottom of the back flap, there's a little listing of all of the different works of art that the designer used to put together the picture on the cover.
Oh,
fascinating.
Yeah.
You know, so this painting and that painting, it's just, and that makes me think that this person was just brilliant, because especially this picture, the picture of the settlement is taken from a wonderful map of that time, the cartouche on the map. And I just think it's brilliant. So I'm so happy that they did that and that they did listen to me.
Yeah. One thing that I loved about it, too, and I don't know if this was on purpose, but the moon, it's like a full moon over New Amsterdam. And there are just a few clouds in front of the moon. And I don't know why, but to me that just sort of felt a little teeny tiny bit sinister, you know, just like.
Yeah, it should feel sinister. And also, though, I mean, there's a full moon that some of the characters are very excited about seeing through the telescope also.
Yeah.
So it's got a couple of different shades of meaning, I think.
Right. And then obviously on the cover, I should mention, too, for people who aren't looking at it, that there's this very sinister hand with a knife and coming in on the side of this canvas, which is the painting.
Well, you know, I thought that was great to have that. And I have to say that one thing that I don't know why it should surprise me, but it has a little bit, that some people are surprised and dismayed a little bit by the gruesomeness of some of the scenes in the book, which when I was working on them, I just thought, well, this is sort of fun in a way to do this, you know, to put it together as a writer. But I can understand how people that have a little bit of a delicate stomach for these kinds of things might have a problem with some of it. But, you know, violence was very much of the age. And so I think it's appropriate that there would be violence in my book.
Yeah. And I think anybody who appreciates sort of a realistic narrative is going to appreciate this book. Because, you know, these orphans are vulnerable. They're at large. No one's really paying attention and looking after them very closely. And as we said, it is a sort of like a little bit of a chaotic atmosphere in the whole community because everything's happening.
And again, you know, that's something else that's historically accurate. The orphans being brought over from Patria, you know, to work on the fields and that kind of thing. That was really happening, and you can read ship manifests of the time that say that, you know. So it's not something that I'm some crazy thing that I'm inventing. It
right.
really existed.
Yeah. Well, it certainly feels very realistic. I wanted to ask you a little bit more about dialogue. Some of the scenes between Blondine and Edward seem to me really great examples of how to write dialogue. They have this wonderful sense of banter and not always getting directly to the point. And so for listeners who are writers, I was wondering if you have any suggestions for writing dialogue.
Yeah, I would say that if I could make a suggestion, it would be to not be, I think it's like you were saying, actually, to not be totally direct and not be totally on point, that people talk around each other a lot and they don't say, you know, so much, you know, would you like a cup of coffee? Yes, I'd like a cup of coffee, you know. They are talking about the weather, or they're talking about some other person, or they could be talking about anything, but they're not necessarily talking about that cup of coffee.
Yeah.
And I think that's, you know, there's a reason for that. And you look at Blondine and Drummond, and they're, you know, they're dancing around each other. And so it makes sense that their dialogue would not be direct all the time, and that's true of most of us, that we're all dancing around each other as we talk to each other. So I think it makes sense to write it that way.
Yeah, and something occurred to me as I was reading this, which I've never thought about before, but reading a really well-written scene between two people who are attracted to one another but haven't yet admitted it to each other. I think that's probably a really good thing to study for writing dialogue, because it will be even, you know, a little bit over the top of what we're looking for in writing good dialogue, because they really are.
That's probably true.
You know, yeah. They're actively obfuscating what they're trying to say. I don't know. It was just
right. But I mean, that there's other examples of that in the book that are not because they are hiding their love for each other, but because they suspect each other.
Mm-hmm. That's true.
You know,
yeah.
Or you know, something's going on that they're not really talking about. There's a lot of that, not just love.
Right. You're right. There's a lot of secrecy, like we were talking about before, and
right.
Yeah.
Right.
All right. Okay, so the book is The Orphan Master by Jean Zimmerman, published by Viking, and I just want to thank you very much for speaking with me today.
Thank you for letting me be here. It was really fun.
I thought that was really fun, talking to Jean Zimmerman. I started out the whole show with a mistake, actually a couple mistakes. So the dedication in The Orphan Master reads, "For the both of us, not just for us," which was kind of fun. And that was for herself and her husband. And it was at her husband's request that she write him a murder. So that was kind of fun. You can learn more about the work of Jean Zimmerman and her research, and also the deleted information about her character, the orphan named William, or maybe not William, at her wonderful website, jeanzimmerman.com. Today's Write the Book prompt was suggested by my guest, Jean Zimmerman, who used to write only nonfiction but has begun writing novels as well. Her work relies heavily on historical research. Jean suggests, because she loves history so much and thinks that everyone would if they knew more about it, she suggests that writers read something historical, something about the history of a time period that they're interested in, whether it's the French Revolution or colonial times whatever, and then sit down and write about a house from that time. Write about the exterior of the house or about the interior, one of the rooms maybe. Don't even try to put people into what you're writing if you don't want to. Just describe that house in intimate detail and see what comes out. Good luck with this prompt, and tune in next week for another. So if you are a Facebook user, I'm hoping you've already gone to Write the Book Radio Show Facebook page and click like. But if you haven't yet, please go and like us. And then if you're interested in sharing the show with out-of-town friends, you should let them know that they can stream it live at theradiator.org every Monday from 2 to 3. Archived episodes of Write the Book are available on iTunes and at writethebook.podbean.com as free podcasts. Also, if you have comments about the show, news about book-related events, or if you have a writing prompt to suggest, please send an email to writethebook@gmail.com. Please remember that this station is here thanks to community support and involvement. More information about The Radiator is available online at theradiator.org. That's it for the show today. This has been Write the Book. I'm Shayla Shapiro, and you're listening to The Radiator, 105.9 FM, WOMM-LP, Burlington, Vermont. Thank you.